You might have noticed that Pat and I are pretty fussy about our finances and our investments.
Yeah, a lot of junk doesn't make it past our bullshit detectors. But one thing that we've both used for many years is ShareSite. It records all dividends, franking credits, transactions, and performance easily in one place.
You can generate reports for income and capital gains, which makes tax time super easy. And ShareSite is completely free if you have 10 holdings or less.
So we've partnered with ShareSite to help support the podcast and provide all our listeners who upgrade to a paid plan a saving of 33% off the annual plan price. If you start with a free plan using our link, you'll still get that discount if you upgrade to a paid plan in the first 60 days.
Just head to ShareSite.com/fire and chill to get started.
Welcome to the Fire and Chill podcast, a collaboration between Dave from Strong Money Australia and Pat from Lifelong Shuffle, where we're going to have regular conversations about fire, investing, and living your best life.
Okay, welcome back. Today we're going to talk about the relationship between time and money, because time and money are essentially interchangeable, and we're going to explore that in some detail today. And there's a few different ways that we can think about this topic, so we'll get into the nuts and bolts of what we mean by that. And we think it's helpful for anyone who wants to improve their financial future, because when we frame things in different ways, especially big topics like time and money, it can really put these things in a different light, give us a new perspective on things. And just a bit of a flag at the start here, we didn't invent any of these ideas, you know. We've learned this stuff over time and from a lot of other people, so we can't take credit for any of this stuff.
Yeah.
And the ideas here have been around for a long time, but me and Pat just want to pass them on because we think they're pretty valuable and they've helped us, and we think that can help you too.
Yeah, God, that's so important. We can speak so confidently sometimes about these things that people think that we're, you know, creative geniuses, but really we're just, we've just read a lot and we're regurgitating a bit of it and we're trying to understand it and put it out in our own way. So definitely keep that in mind. Also, I'd like to say that, you know, this is probably like foundational to financial independence. This is what it's all about. It's all about getting your time back. And how are we planning on doing that? By saving up a huge chunk of money. It shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that time and money are completely interchangeable. That is actually the full basis upon which we are strategizing how to get all our time back. It's by saving up a big chunk of money.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so let's dive into the first point. It is, when we buy things, we know that they come with a sticker price, but how much do they actually cost us? Because it's not just the sticker price that we have to, I guess, concern ourselves with. So how do we figure out how much things actually cost us, Pat?
Well, in the first instance, we should probably understand exactly how much money we make per hour doing our work. And it's also pretty important to understand that it's not the pre-tax income. You have to understand how much you make post-tax for every hour you work. So if you're on, say, $30 an hour or something, you're not actually making $30 an hour. The government is skimming like probably $5 to $10 per hour off the top of that. So really, you're only making about $20 an hour while you're working your day away.
Doesn't sound quite as good, does it?
Definitely not. And this can really put things into perspective when you're, you know, out at the coffee shop and you're buying that $5 coffee and that $10 sandwich. You've only spent $15, right? But that's 45 minutes of your entire day's work right there.
Yeah.
If you are going to extend that out over, say, the entire year, just to make the math a little easy, let's say the coffee and the lunch costed you $20. So over the course of a 48 work week, that's 1 hour a day, 5 times 48, 240 hours of work to pay for your lunch and coffee each day if you're spending an average of $20 a day on lunch and coffee. So exactly what is 240 hours of work? That's 8 hours a day. That is 30 work days per year to pay for your lunch and coffee daily at work.
Man. When you put it like that, it's a little bit, it can't help but feel a little bit depressed by that, don't you reckon?
Oh, wow. It's the image of the mouse in the mouse wheel definitely comes in mind. The mouse is going, spinning the wheel, spending the money, needing to spin it some more just so they could spend the money.
Well, it's like he's spinning around in the wheel and he eats some cheese that gives him some energy and he wants to get some more cheese, so he keeps spinning around in the wheel and he's kind of, you know, he's burning a bunch of his energy up, so he needs more cheese just to keep going to get to the next piece of cheese.
Oh, that's exactly what we all are at the moment, just little mice in my mice wheels.
I was going to say, but it doesn't end there because, I mean, if this cost or somewhere around this cost works out to about 10% of your daily earnings, when if you stretch that out, that actually means that you're working one in every 10 years just to pay for your lunch and coffee combo. That's not great. When you put it in a big number like that, in 1 year out of 10, that's, man, that definitely changes the way I think about it when you compare it to just looking at it on a daily basis.
Yeah, exactly. When you make the dollar amount into a time amount instead. Because often, you know, 10 or 15 bucks can really sound kind of trivial. It's like, oh, whatever, 10, 15 bucks. Like, you don't even give it a second thought, really. But yeah, if you make a consistent habit out of it and you stretch that over long periods of time, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely. But those are just little items. What about the big ticket items as well, Pat?
Ah.
Like, let's consider a car purchase, something that's definitely a big ticket item.
Oh, man, car purchases. This one gets a lot of people, you know. They love those brand new cars, those 30,000, 40,000, even more. Like, I'm being far too conservative. Like,
yeah.
There's people on very, I'll say, average incomes who are spending $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 on a pretty luxury vehicle, which is ludicrous. It doesn't make any sense.
Mm.
You can spend years and years working just to pay for this damned car. But let's get back into the details. I don't want to...
Don't want to veer off into a rant just yet?
If car A costs $20,000 and car B costs $5,000, I think we can get a very reliable car which has a lot of like pretty new, nice features for about $5,000. It won't be like straight off the assembly line, but I was driving a 10-year-old car that cost about $5,000 before work gave me a car. So this isn't some random example that doesn't apply in real life. This is definitely very possible for a lot of people. But both these cars will do exactly the same thing. They'll get you from A to B. If you've chosen the correct car, they'll both get you there quite reliably. Just one is a little less fancy, right? So a car that costs $20,000 costs 1,000 hours of work for someone that earns 20 bucks an hour after tax.
So how much is 1,000 hours of work? Well, it works out to be about 25 weeks of work. Mm. And car B only costs us 250 hours of work, or 6.25 weeks. So it's quite a big difference. It's actually an extra half a year of work for what is really a minor benefit, getting from A to B in a slightly fancier way.
A slightly fancier steel box to get you, for you to be stuck in traffic in while you're on the road to...
What does Mr. Money Mustache call it? Like a luxury motorized racing wheelchair or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, if you want to spend an extra 20 weeks of work so that you can get to work in a slightly fancier way, that isn't a trade-off that I would make. I would just get the slightly less fancy car and spend 20 less weeks at work.
Yeah. But you know what, Pat? It's actually worse than that because people don't pay cash for their cars.
Oh.
They take out loans, so they're paying repayments for 5 years, 7 years. And so by the time they do that, they've paid 60 grand for a 40 grand car, and the car's only worth 20 grand, and then they trade it in and do the whole exercise all over again. So it's actually much worse than we're saying.
Oh, it's so much worse. I did a blog post on the cost of commuting, and it's ridiculous. Like, the amount that it actually costs you in, you know, maintenance, replacement of tires, lost investment income. If you've got a loan out, then the loan interest, the fuel, of course, it adds up big time, and it costs far, far more than I would say the vast majority of people realize.
And even, I think one cost that isn't really appreciated, I think, is opportunity cost. Because even if you've got to pay, because people might think, well, my car's paid off, so I don't really have to worry about, you know, loans and all the rest of it. But there's still an opportunity cost of having your savings tied up in the car. So let's say you've got a $30,000 car, which might be quite nice, when a $10,000 car would do you just fine. There's potentially an extra $20,000 cash that you could have invested there for, you know, 10 or 20 years, which is going to perhaps double or triple in value over 10 or 20 years, which is going to be a lot more useful to you. So That's a massive, massive cost that you wouldn't even see it to look at your car expenses, but it's definitely there in the background. You just don't notice it.
Yeah, exactly. And if you could save $20,000 on buying a car, every 3 or 4 years, that $20,000 will probably return you about $4,000 or $5,000. So you could essentially buy a car every 3 or 4 years that costs about $5,000 in perpetuity just by not spending that $20,000 to begin with.
Yeah, okay. The car I had before this one was actually a car that cost roughly $4,000. And I just ran that into the ground. Like, I had it for about 10 years.
Yeah,
and exactly. So, you know, your $4,000 car is probably going to last you longer than a few years. So that's something else to consider though.
But we're getting off topic here. The point is that...
No. We wouldn't do that, would we?
There's a trade-off. The trade-off is additional time, of course, that you're spending at work to pay for these, what is essentially a luxury item.
And it's not just a one-time trade-off either. It's like a repeated ongoing trade-off for a lot of these expenses. And I guess the car is obviously not a regular trade-off, but it is a trade-off that we'll be making maybe every 5 or 10 years or so.
Yeah, there is a certain cohort of people who are more than happy to upgrade their car every, 3 to 5 years. And they will just, they constantly have to be on that new car bandwagon. And then there's obviously another cohort of people which will, like you said, buy a new car, run it into the ground, which is a bit better. And then there's, we're on the complete other end where we're just going to buy a car that's...
Buy an old car and run that into the ground.
Buy an old car and run that into the ground. But not like a car that's already run into the ground, because there's also plenty of cars out there that perhaps are a bit older, but they haven't got a huge number of kilometers on the odometer. So you're kind of trading the luxury, but you're not necessarily trading the reliability away.
Well, speaking of luxury, we actually bought a car last year, which was about... cost us about $12,000. It's only 4 years old or 5 years old, maybe. And
nice.
It's got relatively low kilometers. And so I'm planning to ride that one off into the sunset for another, 15 years until humans are no longer allowed to drive cars and the robots are driving us around.
Oh, I'm so looking forward to that time.
Yeah, me too.
It's in the future. I know it's in the future. And it's just going to, yes, we're going to be alive for it. I can feel it.
It's coming, mate. It's coming.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Hopefully in our lifetime, it'll get to a point where it's illegal for humans to drive cars.
I think it will. Yeah. That's a topic for another day.
Fair enough.
What about the thought process that some people have where they say to themselves, well, this is okay, I understand this kind of trade-off, but I'll just work more so that I can cover this higher spending. What do we think about that?
I think that's perfectly fine. As long as you're clear about exactly how much you're needing to work more and you're happy with the trade-off, then I suppose that's kind of what we always say. It's like, know the trade-off, spend the money and time on what you find valuable and go for it.
I think the key point is because, like, if someone gets it clear in their mind, this expense equates with me working more, but I'm okay with that. Like, that's a super healthy, super logical way to frame that in your mind, because you've got the trade-off very clear and you're happy with it. So that's perfectly okay.
You're walking into it with your eyes wide open, You're not head in the sand sort of, it's just this much money. It's clear how many extra days or weeks or years of work that's going to take you.
Yeah. Exactly.
No problem at all. I make those trade-offs all the time. I'm sure you do too.
Yeah, because if something's worth it, then it's worth it. That's all there is to it, So.
Yeah, precisely. But we want to put a greater value on our time, right? Because our lives have a finite amount of time. Furthermore, it's even worse than that because we don't know what that finite amount of time is. We don't know how long we've got.
We might think, oh, it's okay. I've got, 80 years, maybe 90 years, maybe a bit longer, but maybe not. We don't know that for sure.
No, we don't, unfortunately.
I think because of that, there is a very good argument for aiming to work less and have more free time so we can experience more life, like as more time in our lives as soon as possible.
Yeah, I think there's a very good argument to try and spend less time doing things that you might not necessarily want to do and trying to direct your life towards things that you would prefer to be doing.
I think we undervalue our time because we assume we have, 80 or 90 years. I guess we don't stop to consider the uncertainty of it all.
Yeah, we're definitely getting into a more philosophical discussion here, aren't we? No, but it's true. It's like no one thinks that they're going to be the person who dies young. Yeah, unsettling thought, of course. But we suppose we have to be, without getting depressed about it, be on the lookout and make sure that you are using your time to the best of your ability, and you hopefully won't have any regrets.
And so I guess this is what financial independence is all about, really. It's being able to build up your savings, build up your investments so that you can then reallocate your time to what you find valuable, which we've said in the past. And this is where it really comes to the fore, is when we think about our time and our lifespan, really.
Mm. And of course, when you're spending money, you're not really spending money. You're spending your time. You're spending your freedom away, because we all trade our time for money.
Mm.
And I think this concept is called life energy, and it's a concept mentioned in Your Money or Your Life, the famous book that everyone in the FIRE community may have heard of or should have heard of by now.
And everybody's probably read it except for me. It's on my list, but I haven't got to it yet. Have you read it?
I did start reading it. I don't know if I got to the end of it. It was wasn't really my style, but I've definitely started reading it. By Vicky Robinson, correct?
Yeah, Vicky Robbins and Joe Dominguez, I think.
Joe Dominguez. Yeah, that's correct. And there's another gentleman that, you know, didn't have a full life.
Mm.
So hopefully he had his priorities straight when he was writing Your Money or Your Life.
Mm. And I think they really championed the idea of figuring out your real full-time wage, which is your wage after tax, after all the costs of going to work and keeping yourself, you know, alive as a human being, kind of what's left over after that. And it becomes a very low number, which kind of opens people's eyes to things.
Oh, yeah, because I think we were being very polite there when we said just your after-tax income. If you take into account all of the time spent traveling to and from work, getting ready for work, purchasing work clothing if you need to do that, like if you add all that up and you actually divide your wage across minus all the little extras and then divide it across the actual amount of time it takes you to get to and from work as well, you end up making bugger all.
You wouldn't want to see that number, I don't think.
No, definitely not.
Here's another point that I thought I'd bring up. I don't know if you've experienced this, Pat, but I thought I'd mention it anyway. The feeling of being able to afford something, the feeling of being able to buy something, is often better than the feeling of actually buying it. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know if I've ever felt that before, man.
I got a little bit of a story here. So when I had my first job as a teenager, I was starting to earn some cash, you know, and I thought, the first thing you think of is, oh, great, I've got some money. What can I do with it? And so you want to spend it. Straight away, you want to spend it. So I noticed I wanted a big kind of TV to put in my room. There was one that I liked, and I think it was like a couple of $1,000s. And I was like, oh, wow, imagine if I could afford that. That would be awesome. And so I kept looking at this TV, and I thought, oh, yeah, I'll save up for this. And so I saved and I saved. And then I had the money in the bank, and I would look at the TV, and I'm like, it didn't look as attractive as it did before once I could actually afford it. For some reason, it was just like the feeling of being able to afford it was better than actually buying it. And then the thought of buying it and then my account being like zero, I was like, it's not that. It's not really worth it. I don't want it that bad. But when it didn't feel like a possibility or like an option because I didn't have the money, I wanted it more. So it's kind of strange. Maybe that was just a bit of a mind quirk that was happening.
Yeah. No, that is. I can't say that I've ever experienced that.
Okay.
But I think you've mentioned it here. Sometimes when I do want something, but when I've got the money, I kind of be like, actually, I don't want to spend. It took me so long to put all that together. It's not worth spending all of it on that.
The same thing happened with a car when I was starting to earn like adult wages and starting to save more money. I thought, oh, I'll buy a nice car. And I was like, I think I was looking at spending like 20 grand or something like that.
Yeah.
And around the same time, I was also starting to think about investing, and I ended up being able to save the money. And then I thought, nah, I can either kind of go this way and spend it on a car, but then I have to start saving all over again, or I can start investing. So I'm glad I chose investing.
Oh yeah, good stuff. That car would have been long gone by now.
It'd be on a rubbish heap somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. So when we say that time and money are interchangeable, we really mean this quite literally. So some people say that time is money, and what they generally mean by that is, you know, when you're at work, if you're wasting time, you're not making money, or if, you know, you're even at home, if you're not using your time productively, you're missing out on your earning potential.
Mm.
What happens if we flip this on its head, Dave? And you've said this, I think, in a previous podcast. Instead of time is money, why don't we just say money is time? So what we mean by this is all the additional money you have is money that you can use to redeem more free time for yourself. So you could call these freedom tokens. Man, this whole topic is so core to the concept of FI. It's just, this is FI in a nutshell. Just recognizing that time is money and money is time, and exploiting that relationship to buy all your free time back.
Exactly. I think that people get it. You know, they think time is money, so I should use my time effectively to make more money. But what about thinking about wasting your money, because you can use that to buy more time? So why don't we think about it that way instead?
And I also think that because we are so wealthy in Australia, it kind of just becomes a non-issue, just spending money a bit carelessly or spending money in a more carefree way, just because we really are wealthy. But if you go back to a time like perhaps during the Great Depression, or you go to other places on the planet where wealth isn't as abundant as it is, I think you'll find that the culture is a lot different. Like, they probably don't spend money as carefree as we have the privilege of being able to do here.
But I think we often forget that because we're in our own little bubble.
We definitely forget it. I suppose some of the key concepts about financial independence and time: if you save, say, 50% of your pay, that means you can work 1 year. And then with the 50% of the money you save during that 1 year working, you can have the next year off.
That's pretty awesome, isn't it?
Oh, that's pretty awesome when you think of it like that, eh?
Yeah.
You can obviously stretch this concept as far as it will go. And once you start including the investment returns you can get on that money you saved, if you save a large enough chunk of money, you can really just live off that chunk of money forever.
Mm. And it doesn't only work with high levels of savings. I mean, even if you just think about it in terms of like a small level of savings, so let's say you're just saving 10% of your pay, that still means that for every, 9 years of work, you can take 1 year off.
Yep, that's correct.
Not many people can say they can do that. That's pretty awesome in itself.
Yeah, well, isn't that what superannuation is?
We've just taken that to its logical extreme, you know?
Well, if you save 10% of your money for 4 decades, you should be able to have... Anyway, you invest it, so it actually juices the numbers up quite a bit.
Yeah, so that money lasts longer, and eventually it lasts forever, essentially, because you're only living on a portion of it each year.
Yeah, exactly. Bottom line from today's chat: we should be conscious of how money and time are interrelated, and how each decision comes with a trade-off which affects your future, and how much free time you have in the future, and how much additional stress you have in the future, and where you can decide to spend your time, and if you can actually spend it on your priorities and what you actually want to be doing.
And once we get control of our money, we will soon have more control over our time. And this is pretty obvious from what we're talking about today.
Mm.
But on the other hand, if we never manage to get control of our money, we'll really never have control of our time, because there'll never be a surplus for us to call on in the future. Because remember, like, any dollar that we save is available to us in the future and can be redeemed for free time, essentially, at any point down the road.
Yeah, and this really is the situation that the vast majority of people find themselves in. They never get control of their money, so they're never in control of their free time. Like you said, we just juice this system, turn it on its head, save up as much as possible so that we can get control of most or all of our time.
Ultimately, both time and money are valuable. I don't think anyone would deny that. But time is really more valuable than money, because we can't replace our time once it's gone. We can't earn more of it. And we really, I guess the other issue is, like we said before, we don't know exactly how much of it we have. So it is a bit more precious in that regard. But either way, we should spend our time and our money both pretty carefully.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's it for this week's topic, Dave. It was a short one, I think, but...
Shall we move on to the listener question?
Yeah, let's move on.
All right, here we go. Have you heard about Vanguard's new personal investor option, and what are your thoughts on it? It looks to me like a massive step in the right direction. So maybe before we answer, Pat, we should just explain a bit about what this is, what it means.
Yeah, good idea. So for anyone who hasn't heard of it yet, we can Just run them through it.
This is a special type of account that Vanguard has brought out where people can sign up directly with Vanguard and open a personal account. And through this account, you'll be able to access all of their managed funds at wholesale management fees for smaller amounts. Usually the wholesale managed funds are only available at low cost for those with very large balances, like $500,000. And you'll also be able to buy any Vanguard Australian listed ETFs without paying brokerage. So this sounds pretty good, but it does come with a cost attached. And so the cost is an annual fee of 0.2% of the total account balance, but it is capped at $600. So essentially the fee maxes out when you have a balance of $300,000.
Yeah.
And when obviously once your balance is above that, the average fee becomes smaller than that because it's spread across a bigger pool of assets.
Yeah, so, the max is $600. So
yeah,
the more money you have, then the less that fee becomes.
Yeah. All right. So that is roughly what it's about. What do we think about it, Pat?
To be honest, I'm not the biggest fan. Though I'm a huge fan of Vanguard, this particular account, I struggle to see who it would be really beneficial for. So the cheapest way, I'll say management fee wise, to get access to Vanguard's products is through ETFs. I think that's very consistent across the board. However, you need to pay brokerage for ETFs. So you can get brokerage for $10 a trade with Selfwealth, and I think is with Perla now. And are they $10 a trade as well?
Yeah, yeah. Or you can be Mr. McFancy Pants like Pat here and pay $20.
That's right. Or you can pay $20 per trade if you want and get a full-on, full-service bank broker if you like. Had to slide that one right in there. I'm not nearly as frugal as people think.
Yeah,
like,
see?
I spend money on some luxuries.
Your story's starting to break apart, Pat.
Yeah, it's completely falling apart. I'm not who everyone thinks
all
I
this
am.
Decadence, mate.
Oh, mate, living this beautiful one-bed apartment in Tarramurra in Sydney.
There's some more decadence that I've learned about your lifestyle that we'll get into in another podcast pretty soon.
Yes, excellent. We will. Okay, back on topic, all Dave. Right. Don't drag us too far off. So then you have the wholesale managed funds, which are a tiny bit more than the ETFs in terms of the management fee. But of course, you don't need to pay brokerage and you can just BPAY straight into them, which I think a lot of people find very helpful.
Yeah.
But of course, these wholesale managed funds have a minimum account balance if you access them directly, which from what people say, it's $100,000. I know the website says 500.
I think it's been changed back now to 500,000. That's what I've read, but I can't confirm that. Oh, either.
Okay. Maybe they're trying to drive people towards their personal investor account.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
So if you absolutely don't want to be using ETFs because you want to use BPAY options, then it makes sense to use the personal investor account instead of investing straight in the retail funds, because the retail funds have much higher MERs.
Hmm.
And of course, if you don't meet the $500,000 threshold, which not a lot of people would when they're beginning.
I started with a bit less than that, I think.
Yeah, me too. But that is the only cohort which that sort of makes sense to use these products. If you're committed to this whole BPAY thing, no brokerage, and you want to use the wholesale funds, it's definitely better than going into the retail funds direct, because it'll be cheaper to pay the 0.2% on top of the wholesale fund fee than to use a retail fund.
Yeah. Just to be clear, you still have to pay management fees on the underlying ETF that you might be buying on this direct account with Vanguard, or the managed fund that you might be buying through this account. You don't just pay the 0.2% and that's it. You still have to pay the underlying fees for the funds that you're investing in as well.
Yeah, this makes no sense for anyone who's using ETFs at all. Yeah.
No, I'd agree with that. I think it might be useful for, like you said, the people who want the wholesale managed funds and to use the BPAY option, because the BPAY option is pretty attractive in terms of its, you know, simplicity and stuff like that. I know people do like that. So that would be that would be a good option for those kind of people. But for those investing in ETFs, I wouldn't bother opening an account for that kind of purpose.
And if you happen to have more than $500,000 to invest, then it doesn't make sense again, because you can just access the wholesale funds directly.
That's probably not many people.
No. Hey, everyone. It's Pat here. I just had to put in a post-recording edit because it turns out that between recording this episode and it coming live to you, Vanguard has made a pretty substantial change to their offering. So what we've just said isn't technically correct, and people aren't actually allowed to access the wholesale funds direct anymore, all the retail funds. So Vanguard really has eliminated all of their other options for managed funds and is directing everyone to go through their Vanguard personal investor account. So it turns out that your options are now a bit more limited, and you either have to invest in ETFs through a brokerage such as Selfwealth or CommSec, or use the Vanguard personal investor account where you can then access Vanguard ETFs and Vanguard managed funds. But that's a pretty substantial change, and I suppose that just reinforces what I said earlier. I can't really see who this option is for, particularly because the main attraction of the managed funds was that people could automatically BPAY into them and not have to tinker or manage or transfer or do anything of that like after doing the automatic BPAY. But now with the Vanguard personal investor account, it's not clear that people are able to just auto BPAY and forget. Seems much more like that they will actually have to go into their Vanguard personal investor account after BPAYing and transfer the funds into a managed fund or into an ETF. So like I said, it just kind of reinforces what we said earlier in that I can't really see who this Vanguard personal investor account would be a really good product for. I personally prefer just to invest in ETFs through my brokerage. And I think Dave is the same. He just prefers to invest in these ETFs through his brokerage as well. But that's a pretty important change, and I just really had to add it in here. So no more direct access to retail and managed funds. You have to go through the Vanguard personal investor account and pay the additional 0.2% fee to access those funds. But if you've already had units bought in a retail fund or a managed fund, you can continue to invest in those, but it's just closed to any new investors. If you're already part of those funds, you can continue to invest, but you can't invest in any new funds. And if you're a new investor altogether, you're going to be forced to use the Vanguard personal investor or invest in ETFs. So I just put it back to the main episode now.
They also mentioned in the kind of announcement that they plan to do super accounts later. Did you see that? That would be pretty good news if that kind of rolled out.
I did see that. And when you look at this personal investor account, the fee structure is identical to the fee structure of a super account. There's an admin fee capped at a certain amount, plus you pay for the MERs of the funds inside it. So every time I look at this, it just looks like it's been set up to facilitate the superannuation option. I'm speculating a bit there, but I just can't get away from it. It's identical to how a lot of super funds do their fee structure. So if this does come through with a capped $600 fee and you can access the Vanguard ETFs or wholesale funds or whatever, then I would jump right onto this immediately.
But people might be wondering there, why is that the case? Because the fees actually look a little bit higher than what you'd be paying at a typical low-cost super fund kind of arrangement invested in index funds.
Oh, God, yeah, you're right. And you're
but that kind of opens up a long conversation.
Yeah, so Dave possibly. And I are definitely going to do a superannuation video very soon. Oh, sorry.
Podcast.
Podcast. Sorry, did I say? No.
You want to do a video?
I don't want to do a video. Podcast very soon. And one of the key aspects I think we're going to cover is what's called capital gains tax provisioning in managed trusts or managed funds.
That sounds pretty exciting, doesn't it?
Oh, God,
I can hear
so
people
exciting.
Falling asleep right now.
Oh, man. It's so, yeah, these topics can feel a bit dry, but this one, I don't know, this one really interests me because it's kind of hidden there. It's not something that you'll notice if you're not doing a ton of research and looking very closely into this. All of those other super funds are what are called, I think, shared managed or managed unit trust schemes or something, and they capital gains tax provision. Anyway, I don't want to get too far into it, but at the end of the day, it just means that it's less tax efficient than investing direct where you just manage the capital gains tax provisioning doesn't happen. And even though these fees are slightly higher than you can get in a really low-cost index fund like Host Plus or Sun Super, mm-hmm. it still might be worth it over the very long term.
Because essentially there's a lot of grey area around this tax provisioning, like you're mentioning, Pat, inside the super funds.
Yeah.
And so,
and just to be clear, we're not saying that the super funds are doing something tricky or they're trying to take money off you. That's not the case at all. It's just a fact about how they need to run the shared pool of money. I don't want to end there because that sounds a bit too...
Yeah.
So yeah, this personal investor option, I wouldn't go for it personally at the moment. I prefer to just invest in ETFs through a brokerage. I think that's a more efficient way to invest at the moment.
Mm.
And I wouldn't recommend it for the vast majority of people. I don't like it as it stands.
Yeah, I'd pretty much agree with that.
Yeah, cool.
All right, thanks for listening to the show. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, we'd love it if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and help other people find the show too. If you do have feedback or topic suggestions, or if you have a question that you'd like us to answer on the show, you can email us at fireandchillpod@gmail.com. We'll talk to you next time.